Columbia Supreme Court hearing room today. And we have a special welcome for some students who are with us. Would the Wisconsin Heights High School students please rise? And a welcome to you all. You may be seated. We also have Edgerton High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. The students are here with us because the Supreme Court and State Bar have a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to join us. If the invitation is accepted, the students will have received copies of the brief of the case they are about to hear, and they may have engaged in various activities relating to this case. Also, as part of the program, the students will meet with a justice of this court after this argument. The subject of the discussion afternoon will be the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in the case. Anyone who wishes may join the students with the discussion with the justice. So let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Rogensack. She's the justice with whom you will meet today. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'll now call our second case for this morning, 2004 AP 2065, Joel Hansen versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company et al. Arguing for American Family Mutual Insurance Company is Randy S. Is it Parley? Yes, ma'am. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning, members of the court, Mr. Tarnoff. My name is Randy Parley. I am an attorney with the firm of Peterson, Johnson & Murray in Milwaukee. I have the privilege of representing the defendants on this appeal. Those defendants are Kevin Caldwell, Lindell Motorsports, and American Family Mutual Insurance Company. Mr. Caldwell is in court with me today, along with Mr. Lindell, who is the owner and operator of Lindell Motorsports. Attorney Randy Goosey of American Family is also with me today in court. My clients and I thank the court for this opportunity to present our case. This lawsuit began with an event almost 6 years ago, a very minor automobile accident. The plaintiff, Joelle Hansen, complained of no injury at the scene of the accident. Later, she complained of neck and back pain. Her treating physician, Seidel, sent her to a neurologist, Dr. Ma. Dr. Ma concluded that there was no clinically significant abnormality in Ms. Hansen's spine, and Dr. Ma further reassured Ms. Hansen that no surgery was necessary as a result of her symptoms. Not satisfied, Ms. Hansen went to see a second doctor, a neurosurgeon named Dr. Siberviola. He concluded the same as Dr. Ma, namely that there was no clinically significant abnormality in her spine and there was no indication for surgery. Finally, she went to a third doctor, James Lloyd, also a neurosurgeon. Because of her chronic complaints of neck and back pain, he performed spinal surgery about 6 months after the accident occurred. This doctor also testified at trial that Ms. Hansen had a historical tendency to express physical symptoms without any organic cause.
Did she have a neck pain or back pain before the accident?
There was no evidence at trial, Justice Wilcox, that she had any such pain.
So when the Court of Appeals found that Hansen was injured in the accident, and Caldwell hasn't appealed that finding, was the Court of Appeals incorrect? In other words, they made that finding?
The Court of Appeals was correct in that finding, Justice Wilcox.
They were correct that she was injured in the accident then?
Correct. Which is what the jury also concluded.
Yes. So the issue here, basically, if I understand it, is what you're saying is that she may have suffered some injury, but whatever it wasn't the injury that was, let's say, that Dr. Lloyd operated for. That's basically your argument.
Correct.
So why isn't Dr. Lloyd here as a third-party defendant?
He could have been joined as a third-party defendant by the defendants. That theoretically, that's possible. That was just simply a strategical decision that the defendants in this case decided not to do.
Okay, go ahead. I've got another question.
Okay. And just to further address your point, Justice Wilcox, we essentially conceded, based on the verdict, that she had a soft tissue injury to the musculature of the back and the neck, without conceding that she had any injury to the spine itself, namely the bony structure or the neurological structures therein.
So what is a person to do if you indicated that she had a tendency to complain? She went to three doctors, maybe four. She had a family physician who referred her to Dr. Lloyd. Dr. Lloyd was one of three people. He said, you've got a problem, you need surgery. Two other people said that she didn't. But you concede, if I'm not mistaken, although in your brief in response to the amicus, she did this in good faith, didn't she?
The actual 1710 jury instruction discusses only the issue of whether the plaintiff exercised reasonable care in selecting the physician.
Yeah, in your
other case, we conceded that.
Yeah, so she exercised reasonable care. What I'm trying to get at is that you had an accident. I know that there are arguments whether it was 5 to 7 miles an hour or 35 to 55, and the pictures are in your appendix. But there was an accident, there was injury, and the argument is over the extent of the injury, but one of the doctors, Lloyd, said injury which came from the accident, I mean there was an injury, and he operated on 5 cervical, I think it was 5 and 6. And you want this court to allow you to make an argument that this goes too far.
Oh, yes, Your Honor, and that's the core of it. It bears reiterating that, yes, there was a dispute between different doctors as to the nature of her injury and the location. There was a dispute as to what care should reasonably be done to ameliorate the symptoms that she was expressing. That, as we construe it, is a classical jury consideration. It's a classical issue for the jury to consider. The jury did consider that and make its decision. Our problem was with the Court of Appeals decision, or the aspect of the Court of Appeals decision, which took that verdict away and ruled that since one of the doctors, the consulting doctor, Paul, characterized the unnecessary surgery as unnecessary, that that constituted medical malpractice as a matter of law, therefore allowing recovery under the 1710 instruction and the case law interpreting it. That's the problem that we have with it.
It wasn't part of your problem also with what the trial court said. You have this, as we call it, this instruction revised done by the judge of 1710, and then he had some commentary about medical malpractice.
Yes.
Which the jury heard.
Yes.
So,
and,
go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. And it puts me in a, I guess for lack of a better term, nostalgic position when you raise that point, because it forces me to think back upon this very contentious trial and what happened during this trial. We had two lawyers who were pursuing entirely different theories of this case, one based on a malpractice, one based on a standard tort. And Judge Gooley at times was exasperated trying to reconcile the different factions. And he saw this case as deviating on a malpractice track that was inappropriate, because this was a standard automobile accident case, not a malpractice case. And I believe that is why you see the language in this custom instruction made up by Judge Gooley literally telling the jury this is not a malpractice case, because he was trying to get us all back on track.
Sure, but then it gave the jury, and this is where I have, it's like, I don't want to mischaracterize as two ships passing in the night in the sense that they didn't quite connect. And but the jury heard the part about the malpractice. And you could look at it one of two ways, and that is if the jury determined that the surgery was not causally, you know, related to the accident, couldn't their verdict just as well have demonstrated that they found that Hansen had been injured by the accident, but then the jury misapplied the Selleck case? You know, you refer to the Selleck case talks about aggravation. It talks about taking people as they are. That's where I get a bit confused.
I think, Your Honor, that if you look at the overall context of the instruction and the overall context of this case and the what I would characterize as an avalanche of evidence destroying the causal connection between this accident and this surgery, any anomalies within the instruction are relatively nominal. Any potential mischaracterizations or misconstructions of the law that the jury may have taken away from this case, from the instruction, is nominal. Judge Gooley, this is rather ironic, because if you compare what he said with 1710, it goes into vastly greater detail than 1710, I believe, is no more than two sentences. Judge Gooley, prior to giving this instruction, went through the Selleck case, went through the Spencer case, went through the cases mentioned in the comments to the instruction, and fleshed out his understanding of this legal principle and reflected that in his instruction. From the standpoint of included content, the instruction is superior. Now, as to the malpractice aspect of it, if you compare that single statement with his very definitive statement to the jury, the defense is not allowed to do this. At least twice in that instruction, Judge Gooley explicitly, pointedly, and very definitively stated, expressing it within the context of the facts of this case, that a defense lawyer representing an insurance company may not stand before you and say the treatment was improper, the treatment was unacceptable, therefore cut the recovery. He explicitly said that. From that aspect, Justice Wilcox, that instruction is in fact superior to the pattern instruction 1710.
Counselor, if you, your client causes an accident and injures a party, if that party has an innate weakness that the general public doesn't have, you're still responsible for the extra damages that person suffers because they were weaker than the normal population, correct?
Absolutely, Justice Rogan said.
You know, I haven't read the record and I've only read the briefs, I have to tell you that, but it appears to me that perhaps Ms. Hansen is a bit somatically oriented and this accident may have aggravated her need to be treated, whether the first doctor thought she needed it, nope. The second doctor thought she needed, nope, but she found a third doctor that said, oh, yes, you do. Well, why isn't that need that was set in motion by the accident then covered under our statement in Selleck?
Your Honor, our position is that the measure of causation in a personal injury action cannot be that thin. Let me explain more specifically what I mean. The presumption that I take when I try a lawsuit is that the causal determination as to whether an accident is causally related to an injury is based on science. It's based on medicine. It's based on the substantive, factual, empirical analysis from the standpoint of medical science.
Well, I agree. I mean, I'm assuming the surgery is totally unnecessary. That's not the import of my question. The import of my question is, if this woman did have an inability to reconcile the injury with, which happened to her without some significant intervention by a medical professional, then didn't the accident aggravate that weakness in her as though she had fragile bones and so she had a result that showed up in her bones? Here it appears it may have showed up in her mind, but I'm having a hard time understanding why that isn't causally related to the accident.
Well, we say it's not causally related from the standpoint of proximate cause.
Well, we don't use that anymore. That's our old public policy analysis now. I understand proximate cause is now, of course, the legal cause, which we would then – but I don't want to go in that direction. What I want you to look at for me is, to me, this seems like the eggshell plaintiff, except instead of having brittle bones, she's got a brittle psyche. And the accident got her thinking she was hurt, and until she got someone to treat her for being hurt, she kept on.
Well, to state it then within the public policy rationale, we would state that the causation, to allow causation in that circumstance, is too remote from the circumstances of the actual accident. Now, the causal locus becomes not the nature of the accident itself and the nature of the resulting harm or the injury. The causal locus becomes the psychology of the plaintiff, him or herself, and that plaintiff's relationship with a given doctor. It also, from our perspective, gives rise to, as I have indicated in the brief, a number of potential almost abuses, we might call, of the medical system, whereby a person gets rewarded, in a sense, for this seeking out of this additional care, even where there is no substantive medical need for it.
Yeah, but counsel, that probably happens on a regular basis.
Counsel, the problem that I see is how does one really parse this out? If there's going to be a battle, and we have the case law, we have Selleck in the other cases I won't cite, but there's a real difficulty here that if you're saying, well, it's psychosomatic, it's not really there. But as Justice Robinsack is raising, this person suffered soft tissue injury. There's no question about that. The question was how great that was. And if you have three doctors on one side and one doctor on the other side, is this what it's going to boil down to, that then we're going to have all of this testimony? It'll be for the jury to sort out when this court has said, I think, that if there's any aggravation, anything related. Obviously, this was a neck injury. If it was, and I think one of you pointed this out in your brief, if it's, I have a neck injury and all of a sudden my big toe is bothering me, there isn't that connection that there is in this case.
Well, Justice Wilcox, and also to address Justice Rogensack's concern, there's going to be a variety of different kinds of evidence on this issue. And the jury will hear this, and the jury will listen to this evidence. Maybe it's three doctors to one, maybe it's two doctors to one. And they'll weigh the evidence, as every jury does and should, and make their decision on that point. But it comes to a situation where, when are you going to award these damages as a matter of law? And our point is that has been reached here. Now, Your Honor, you made the distinction. Well, what happens if you have a injury in one part of your body, and then there's another injury in your toe, something far removed? We submit, Justice Wilcox, that is this case. There was...
Well, no, this is a neck in the neck. It's not a neck in the toe.
Well, there again, we get into the same kind of argument that a jury might consider, which is exactly what was argued at trial. We made the medical differentiation at trial between the soft tissues within the back, the muscular part, and the spine. The issue in this case, Your Honor, was whether there was a spinal injury. We defined the spine. Dr. Paul, our consultant, defined the spine, and I think all of the doctors defined the spine as the bony structure and the neurological structures therein, firmly differentiated from the muscles and the soft tissue type of injury. I, in fact, believe that's exactly the distinction that the jury made in their verdict.
Go ahead.
So to respond to your argument, I believe this case, the
difference. It's not an argument, it's just a question.
To respond to your
You're
question.
Making the argument.
It doesn't feel that way.
Oh,
yes.
I wasn't trying to grill.
I'm teasing.
My comments are.
Since you responded. My concern is this. Look, you talk about the causal locus and the empirical data and all this sort of stuff. What happens is this, that you get a person that's injured, sometimes there are malingerers and sometimes there are people who are stoic. I mean, it's all across the board. But let's take the run-of-the-mill person. All of these students have aunts and uncles and moms and dads, and they can get in a car accident. And what are they going to do? They're going to go to the doctor, and the doctor is going to then tell them to go to another doctor, right? Maybe, you know, an expert like we have here. And then there's going to, if there's a claim in insurance, there's going to sometimes be another doctor. And it is not unusual for there to be competing either diagnoses or competing suggestions on what the appropriate treatment is. I mean, that is part of the daily fare of these kinds of cases. I mean, we see it all the time. So what's the person supposed to do? What are their aunts and uncles supposed to do? What are their moms and dads supposed to do? Well, they're supposed to act reasonably. They're supposed to, with ordinary care, pick a doctor, and if they do that, exercising ordinary care, and we throw in some, I guess, good faith someplace along the line with case law, we have said several times, starting in Selig, but many times Spencer is another one, what's a person to do? And the answer is, Spencer asked the same question, is Spencer to be faulted because he chose to follow erroneous medical advice? Well, we've made that balance. So tell me where I'm wrong. I mean, I don't know if this person's a malingerer. I don't know if it's psychosomatic. You know, I don't know if it's a soft tissue injury or it really does go into the spine. I don't know if it's the thoracic, top thoracic, bottom cervical. I mean, who knows? But you got someone here who's injured, who's following the doctor's advice and doing it in good faith and exercising ordinary care and doing it. And haven't we decided this case a long time ago?
2 points about that, Justice Bradley. First of all, I'm glad you mentioned how common that is, that this occurs not only in everyday life, but in personal injury cases. The vast majority of cases that I have tried have involved issues such as this. To what extent, yes, to what extent did the medical treatment become reasonable, and at what line, at what point did it become unreasonable? That is why the commonality of this, the commonplace nature of this factual scenario, is what is of greatest concern to me with the Court of Appeals, because basically if you read that decision, if one of the doctors indicates, if a defense doctor says, this treatment was unnecessary, and defense doctors say that all the time.
All the time. That's why you hire the defense. That's why I would hire the defense doctor. I knew what defense doctor is going to say, surgery is not needed. Let's do conservative treatment.
Yes.
I mean, that's why you hire them, right?
Yes. And the concern is, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals essentially ruled that if this allegation of unnecessary treatment is made, that morphs into a malpractice allegation, which requires recovery as a matter of law for those unnecessary expenses under the 1710 line of cases. Selleck, what you mentioned, Spencer, that you mentioned, none of those cases went that far. None of those cases stand for that proposition, that as a matter of law, unnecessary medical treatment is recoverable. If that becomes the law, it undercuts the most common defense that all personal injury defendants make in these cases. Yes, I know you look like you want to say something.
That got to another point that's a problem for mine. You know, this whole malpractice stuff. I mean, some of the cases, earlier cases, don't talk about malpractice. They talk about incorrect treatment. I mean, can't you have incorrect treatment without malpractice? I think so.
I agree, Justice Bradley, with that point made in Mr. Tarnoff's brief. I think that what you call it, what label you put on it, is essentially irrelevant. You can call it malpractice. You can call it improper treatment. You can call it excessive treatment.
That's right. Some cases say improper treatment. I don't think all improper treatment is malpractice. I don't think all incorrect treatment is malpractice.
And if we need to decide these issues within the context of a personal injury case, doesn't this support the allegation made by the defense here that we're getting off into a totally separate diversion into the malpractice issues, which is precisely what Judge Gooley tried to rein in on this case? If I may just make one point, Justice Bradley, you mentioned, and there seems to be a presumption among the members of the court, that Ms. Hansen pursued this line of treatment in good faith. We did stipulate at the trial court level that she exercised reasonable care in selecting her physician. We did not stipulate to the separate consideration under Spencer and that line of cases that the plaintiff under consideration have followed the doctor's advice in good faith. That's a separate consideration.
But you argue, I don't want to interrupt, but you argued that when the amicus, I mean, you had your reply to the amicus brief, that was on page 5 or 6 or something.
Yes. And one thing I didn't mention, Justice Wilcox, I talked about the fact of the somatization, but to supplement the brief in that regard, another indicator of bad faith was the fact that she went to 2 physicians prior to seeing Dr. Lloyd, who did perform the surgery, who gave her opinions adverse to his.
Counselor, why is that bad faith to go and see another doctor? I mean, if you really feel that your neck is hurting, what's wrong with seeing and getting another opinion? I don't understand that.
Justice Rodensack, I wouldn't say it's bad faith as a matter of law. I think it's a fact that bears upon the issue of whether she exercised good faith. I think it's a fact that a jury could legitimately consider in deciding that issue. And the hypothetical was made, well, you go to one doctor, you're not satisfied, you go to a second, you go to a third, you go to a fourth. When do you draw the line? This is what the defense is asking. Is it at the 5th doctor that the defense can legitimately say this is unnecessary, this is improper? Is it the 6th? It's the 7th? Absolutely correct, Justice Bradley. This process of consulting different doctors can go on ad infinitum.
Sure. And people who have chronic pain, you know, I mean, and we all know them. I mean, they search for some kind of relief.
How would we draw that line? How would you tell us to draw that line?
We draw that line. It doesn't require any change in the law. You draw the line simply by reaffirming the principle that this is a jury consideration to be made after consideration of the entire panoply of evidence that bears upon the issue. That's what we had in this case. We had this jury hearing all of this evidence, including the evidence on the good faith issue about the somatization, about the other doctor she had seen. They made their decision based upon this evidence. And we're saying, unlike what the Court of Appeals did, this issue should not be, if I may loosely use the term, hijacked from the jury and decided as a matter of law.
Mr. Parley.
Go ahead, Chief.
Mr. Parley. First, I note that good faith sometimes appears in these cases in selecting the doctor.
Yes.
And sometimes it appears in the cases, at least as you explain the cases, in following the treatment course. So I'm not sure if these cases are conflicting or they're not, but you agree with my observation?
Yes, Chief Justice Abrahamson, and 1710 talks only about good faith in selecting the physician.
Okay.
The other cases do raise the additional criteria.
Some of them do, but Liv Rowe, for example, which is cited there and quoted there, just talks about it, due care and good faith in selecting. Okay. That's my first sort of observation with you. And here's what's bothering me. I'm going to give you 2 examples.
Okay.
So you're in a car accident, you have a broken leg. And you go to the doctor, and because there's incorrect treatment, you wind up with an amputation. You, I assume, agree that the insurance company insuring the auto accident pays for the amputation and everything that follows.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay. Because in that case, there is no question that there is causation between the accident and the broken leg. And whatever follows from the broken leg, you're liable.
Correct.
Okay. Now, we're in a car accident, and a couple of weeks after the accident, small accident, the male notices he has bunions all of a sudden. And goes to a doctor, and the result of the bunions with the incorrect procedures and so winds up with an amputation. Now, if I understand your argument, you would say that the jury should be instructed first to find whether the bunions were caused by the accident.
Yes, that's part of the analysis.
If the bunions were caused, the jury finds the bunions were caused by the accident, the injury is caused by the negligence, then your company is going to be liable for everything through the amputation.
Everything within the stricture of the jury admonition or instruction that within reason.
Yep. If you use ordinary care in selecting and the doctor was negligent and the negligence aggravated the injuries or failed to reduce the injuries, the plaintiff's damage for personal injury is the entire amount of damages sustained and not decreased because of the doctor's negligence.
Correct.
That's 1710. Okay.
Yes.
Now, but in the Bunyan situation, you want a special verdict question. Were the bunions caused by the accident?
Could.
But I'm trying to do it theoretically.
Yes.
All right. If the jury answers yes, you're totally liable under 1710. If the jury answers no, then you don't want to pay for any of that because there was no cause. Isn't that, that's your theoretical argument.
Correct.
Here you have a case, I suggest, that falls in between the two because you're going to have a difference of medical testimony as to whether the spinal issues were caused by the auto accident. And so you want, in effect, to have instructions asking the jury to first find cause before they give damages for everything.
Yes.
And you think Gallet's instruction did that?
The instruction given in the trial court?
Right.
Yes.
That's Judge Gallet's instruction.
Yes.
Did that. Well, if that's true, then do we have to change all the instructions? Was there a causal instruction here?
The general rule that I follow when I try cases and I draft instructions is that you look at the pattern instructions. But as the case law states, if there is a peculiarity in the evidence or a unique issue phrased by the evidence, you can submit a requested special verdict or an instruction that is outside the standard type of instruction. If you're faced with a case that raises a very unique issue, as you have raised, Chief Justice.
I think this case, you're saying this case raises that unique issue.
Theoretically, yes.
Because I think it falls between the two cases I gave you.
It's entirely possible. I never thought of it, frankly, but I could have requested a special verdict question exactly on the spinal issue.
You did not.
I did not.
And what was the causal? Was it the ordinary instruction on cause?
Well, those principles were embedded in that single custom instruction that Judge Gooley gave.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also the instruction about recovery of medical expenses reasonably related to the accident, the standard instruction. Judge Gooley, if you look at the custom instruction, which is in the appendix of my initial brief.
At page 16 of your appendix.
Correct. He talks about, he melds together, so to speak, the 1710 type of instruction with the general causation instruction given in personal injury cases.
Didn't he give 1500? I mean, that's the one on cause.
I do not recall offhand if he did or he did not.
Okay.
But whether he did or did not, I know that 1710 does talk about some of those issues.
The problem, though, as I see it, is you had two injuries. On one, you in effect say it's causal and you're willing to pay. On a second, which is simultaneous one, if the plaintiff here is correct, on that one, you're saying it's not causal. So what you've got are jury instructions that meld the two, and so the jury, if you pay strict intention here, does not have the two separated out. I mean, that's, as I understand your brief and argument, and I will say I found it somewhat confusing because I kept thinking it was a shifting argument for both sides. This is not a criticism of yours or the other side because it was hard for me to understand this. So you may have needed to separate out these two injuries and given two instructions and et cetera. I'm not sure, but I hear you saying that in effect. Are you?
No.
In an ideal situation.
Yes, ideally in retrospect, perhaps. I don't think it was material, and I don't think that the failure to do that caused any error in this case, because the general principles that the jury were given in terms of causation, in terms of 1710, could apply to any allegation in the case as to whether the accident caused any particular injury. For example, the jury concluded, I believe you can rationally infer from the verdict, that she did suffer a soft tissue injury, that there was a causal connection between the accident and a temporary soft tissue soreness in the muscles of the neck and back. The jury was given in the evidence an entirely separate body of facts concerning whether there was injury to the spine, which we construed at trial as a completely different area of the body. Exactly as you have said, Chief Justice, those are two separate allegations of injury to two separate areas of the body. And I believe the instruction allowed the jury to make that assessment accurately as to both of those separate injuries and whether they were causally related to the accident. If that is what your concern was, Chief Justice, did I accurately state that it was two different injuries that were being alleged?
That's what you're, in effect, saying. And you're saying as to one, you agree with her, as to the other, you do not. And you don't agree because you don't think it's causal, regardless of the psychological issues or predisposition or anything else. Not causal, you don't pay. That's, in effect, your position as to one of her injuries.
Right. A position supplemented by our contention that, in fact, all those different facts that bear on all those issues are to be presented to the jury, and ultimately it becomes a jury issue, which is what we did in this case.
Now, in your reply brief on page 5, to the defense bar, the truly disturbing aspect of the Court of Appeals decision is the following statement. When the doctor is selected in good faith, that's the selection, as Faust and LeRoux have explained, responsibility for improper, even unnecessary treatment for an injury received in the accident cannot be avoided by claiming the accident did not cause the later treatment.
Yes.
So it's your last part of it, cannot be avoided by claiming the accident did not cause the later treatment. How would you write that sentence?
I would eliminate that sentence. I would simply phrase it in terms of what 1710 states as reflective of the underlying case law and what 1710 was intended to do. It was merely intended to prevent a party from saying this treatment was improper, you cannot reduce the amount of the recovery for that.
I would suggest, and you have an opportunity in rebuttal, look at that sentence. I think if you change one word in that sentence, that sentence might be satisfactory to you. And the word to be changed is 2-4, the fifth line down in the instruction, responsibility for improper, even unnecessary treatment for an injury caused by the accident. The two words, I'm sorry, caused by the accident, cannot be avoided by later claiming the accident did not cause the later treatment. So it's not...
Chief Justice Abrahamson, that's this entire case.
That's what I understand then.
Yes, that's the
sentence. But if you change those two words, that sentence would be perfectly okay with you, I thought.
I am not going to disagree with you.
That's a good idea. Thank you. Your time is up. I'm sorry, are there any further questions? Okay, you've time in rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Tarnoff, Michael I. Tarnoff, representing the plaintiff appellant Joe L. Hansen. Mr. Tarnoff.
I'm Michael Tarnoff from the Wyschewski Law Firm, represent the plaintiff Joe L. Hansen in this case. The petitioners would have this court believe that the Court of Appeals' decision in this case made some drastic change in Wisconsin law, and now many personal injury cases will be virtually indefensible. The Court of Appeals in their decision applied rules set forth for many, many years, starting with Selleck, followed by Faust and Leverow. There was nothing new here, which was why the Court of Appeals' unanimous decision was not recommended for publication. In the face of Faust and Leverow, Both of those decisions are so supportive of our position in this case. Petitioners have taken essentially a shotgun approach with numerous arguments that have no basis in the facts of this case and no support in any Wisconsin appellate decision. They set forth a
Mr. Tarnoff, let's start. I asked opposing counsel a similar question, but as far as the causal relationship here, what evidence was presented to the trial court which showed that this surgery was causally related to the accident? Do you recall offhand?
Yeah, numerous things. First, we start with this fact. The jury found that she was injured in the accident, awarded $25,000 in medical expenses, which were virtually all the medical expenses before she was referred to Dr. Lloyd involving the surgical treatment. Therefore, they found that she was injured. They found then that all of the treatment before being referred to Lloyd was reasonable and caused by the accident. This includes the single most important reason why she was referred to Dr. Lloyd was that there was a C5, C6 radiculopathy found on the EMG by Dr. Ma. And that was the principal reason why her family doctor, Dr. Seidel, referred her on to Dr. Lloyd. This didn't involve somatization was not an element in this case. There was never any claim that she didn't act in good faith by going to see Dr. Lloyd. Their doctor, their expert, when asked that, said, no, she did nothing wrong. She was perfectly understandable that she'd follow her doctor's advice. He had no criticism of her whatsoever, strictly criticism of Dr. Lloyd. Anyway, she then gets referred to Dr. Lloyd, who then does surgery, according to their doctor, because of a misdiagnosis of what her injuries were. But this is in no way her fault, and it certainly was caused by the accident in the sense that the original reason that she was referred to Dr. Lloyd was because of injuries sustained in the accident. Again, their expert, Dr. Paul, corroborates that. When asked, well, why was she sent to Dr. Lloyd in the first place? He says, well, because it was because of this accident. That's why she was there.
You heard the questions that the Chief Justice had, and my question would be to you, how could a defendant present evidence of no causal connection? That basically is what I think troubles your opposing counsel here, is that if the court were to say, yes, we agree, and there was good faith, and we go ahead, what do you do, or how can you show the jury, and this would be a jury question, that basically the negligence of the tortfeasor, there was negligence here, without inadvertently raising these questions of either malpractice or unnecessary surgery or something like that? In other words, I understand, I think we do, his argument is, how do you cut off any excesses? How do you deal with that?
Well, because in some cases...
I'm not saying there were any, I'm not going to make that conclusion, but I'm just asking you,
okay. What
could be done?
Well, what could be done, in many cases, that argument can be made, because the selection of the doctor, not only does the selection of the doctor have to be done in good faith, which was undisputed in this case, but seeking and continuing the treatment has to be done in good faith, which was not an issue in this case. Question you raise, can they in some cases argue that even though the selection of the doctor was done in good faith, that the follow-up treatment was not done in good faith? Yeah, you could have fact situations where that kind of scenario would arise. For example, let's say there's no dispute that the doctor was selected in good faith. And the doctor prescribes $15,000 worth of physical therapy, and the defense doctor says, out of that, $3,000 was reasonable. The rest was unnecessary. A jury doesn't have to, if a plaintiff testifies, says, well, I went along with all this treatment, because what do I know? I'm a lay person, he's the doctor, so I went along with it. A jury may view that testimony as disingenuous and decide not to award all or even any of the additional medical expenses in that fact situation. But that's not what we had in this case. This case, the good faith of the plaintiff was not an issue. She was referred to Dr. Lloyd because of objective findings, primarily because of objective findings found in an EMG, which led to the referral, and that's why she had the surgery.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but we raised that good faith issue with opposing counsel, and I indicated, and I think in the reply brief to this is to the amicus brief on pages 5 and 6, they do raise the issue of good faith here. In other words, they maybe in a different context, but it is raised.
Yeah, raised for the first time in this entire case through the trial court, the court of appeals, this court, the petition for review. First time it was raised was about 10 days ago in the brief that you're referring to. That simply there was no issue of good faith. There's no evidence that she did not act in good faith. Her own doctor, her expert, said that she acted in good faith. She, when asked of any criticism, or was she exaggerating, did she do anything wrong in following Dr. Lloyd's advice? Among other things, there was a little error, I think, in the scenario described by counsel. She was treated initially by her family doctor. He refers her to a neurosurgeon, Dr. Ma, who does the EMG, which turns out to be positive. It's C5, C6 radiculopathy. It's an objective test, nothing that she could feign or fake.
And so what is radiculopathy?
Radiculopathy is like when you've got paresthesia or a feeling of nerve tingling down the arm. That's like it's an indication that there could be some nerve involvement emanating from C5, C6, which is, of course, the cervical spine. And that's
what does it show? I mean, when the doctor described radiculopathy, what does he say? Are the bones funny? Is the disc between the bones funny? What's the problem?
Usually it involves a disc, which is what Dr. Lloyd eventually did the surgery on. It tells the doctor that there's something going on here more than a simple muscular soft tissue injury, which is the primary reason that they referred her to Dr. Lloyd, a neurosurgeon. So her good faith was never an issue in this case. It can be in some cases, and you can pick out scenarios and fact situations where ongoing treatment could be challenged as not being done in good faith. But in this case, that was not an issue. So if this court decides to elaborate or perhaps change the rule a bit, change the instruction, whatever, it doesn't apply to the facts of this particular case.
Can I ask you and present the same issue I did to opposing counsel? In the broken leg or bunion situation. Okay, broken leg, doctor doesn't do it properly, amputation, insurance company's liable. That's the standard kind of case of injury is caused, and then you have really unforeseen and unfortunate circumstances, but the defendant has to pay, right?
Right.
Okay. Then you get the bunion case where bunion not caused by the accident happens very short time thereafter. Now you have a broken arm and the bunion, and you result in amputation of the leg. Is it your position that the insurance company has to pay for the leg?
If the initial injury, the bunion injury initially, the bunions were not caused by the accident?
Right, not caused by the
accident. Then they're not responsible.
They're not responsible. Okay.
But in this case, again, it's crucial to one of the things they argued, among many other arguments they made at the trial level, was that she wasn't injured at all, give her nothing. So it was too minor an impact, so don't award anything. But the jury awarded $25,000. That says that, yes, she was injured. The injury was to her neck. All of this treatment was reasonable up until the point where she saw Dr. Lloyd. And the reason that they didn't award anything for the surgery was because, as the Court of Appeals went into at great length, was because of the garbled and convoluted and incorrect instruction by the trial court.
All right. Let's suppose we were turning back the clock and we were going to try this as a mock trial to show how it really might have been done. Because you don't know all the problems until after the trial is over, after the appeals are over, et cetera, right?
Right.
And you have the insurance company saying, in my mock trial, soft tissue caused by the accident, we'll pay for everything. spinal injury not caused by the accident, we don't want to pay for that. And if that were the trial, should you have the jury instructions and special verdict questions carefully marked and carefully stated that there are two injuries here, potential, they are on different tracks, and you make a decision, you, the jury, on each track? I mean, would that be the way this should be tried from the plaintiff's standpoint?
If there's an issue that arises in the evidence that perhaps the additional treatment was not done in good faith, it could be an issue.
Coming to cause. Never mind good faith. Everybody's good faith. Everybody's terrific. The question really is that spinal injury caused by the accident? Or is it something else? You know, people slip discs all the time, I guess. And there's been no injury, right?
Well, sure, but there has to be something in the record that indicates that the injury came from something other than the accident. If there's nothing but testimony that the injury was caused by the accident, if it leads to surgery and there's a dispute about whether the surgery was necessary or not necessary, whether labeled as malpractice or not, it's still recoverable by a plaintiff if it emanated from the original injury sustained in the accident.
I gather your position here is the spinal injury, what I call the spinal injury, the disc injury, was caused by the accident. Nothing in this record says it wasn't caused by the accident. Therefore, the only problem in the verdict here was that the instructions were garbled.
Dr. Paul says that there was no disc injury. Their doctor said there was no disc injury, so that was a dispute. But the whole thing that Faust and Leverill say is that if someone is injured, there's no question that she had a neck injury and she had an injury to her cervical spine that led to her being referred to Dr. Loy, and the jury found that. So that under that scenario, she should have been awarded all of her medical expenses, which is what the Court of Appeals decided.
Reply brief of, you heard me read the sentence that's of great question here, the sentence in the Court of Appeals decision. You're here saying we should affirm the Court of Appeals.
Right.
Do you agree with that sentence?
With the sentence that the Court of Appeals?
Right.
That sentence is a correct statement of Wisconsin law.
Would it be as correct if we substituted the words caused by instead of received in?
I don't know. It depends on the context of the entire instruction. It would have to say that if the injuries that led to whatever the treatment turned out to be were caused by the accident and the treatment was followed as a matter of good faith, and you say it's always that way. In many cases, it isn't that way. In this case, it was. Then yes, as a matter of law, all of the medical expenses should be awarded, which is just what the Court of Appeals did in this case. And as far as the instruction goes, the trial court had a lot of trouble with the fact that the issue of malpractice came into this case. And although counsel didn't in oral argument get into this, but he stated throughout their entire brief that we're not allowed, as the plaintiff, we can't do this, in quotes, offensively. We can't bring out the fact that their doctor feels that there was medical malpractice by the treating neurosurgeon. There's no case that says we can't do that, and it would be absurd that we can't cross-examine their medical expert and ask if he thinks that this treatment was medical malpractice by the treating doctor. Certainly we have the right to do that. There's no case that says anything to the contrary. And I should add that an IME doctor, defense consulting doctor, stating that treatment was malpractice is extremely rare. Talking about unnecessary treatment and so forth is reasonably common, but labeling something as malpractice is extremely rare. It happened to me once in 43 years as a tort lawyer. It happened once, this case. So it's not going to lead to, as counsel implies in their brief, that it's going to lead to all kinds of mini malpractice trials, and that this hasn't happened since Faust and Leverill, and it's not going to happen.
Mr. Tarnoff,
Justice Butler has a question.
Thank you, Chief.
As I understand your argument, and I want to paraphrase the opposing counsel's argument as well, because I think that will crystallize it for me, the whole gist of your argument is, look, we have one injury here. It was an injury caused by an accident, and as a result of that injury, we may have had some mistreatment, some maltreatment by the physicians in treating that injury, but I'm dealing with one injury, therefore, Faust and liberal control. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And as I understand opposing counsel's argument, what opposing counsel is essentially arguing is that, look, you have two injuries here. You have the injury that was caused by the accident, and you have the injury that was caused by the doctor. Is that a correct statement? At least, is that how you would paraphrase opposing counsel's argument?
Yeah, you could paraphrase it that way. The injury was caused by the doctor, but the injury caused by the doctor emanated and resulted from the original injuries that she sustained in the accident to begin with. That's why she was there seeing this doctor to begin with.
And looking at opposing counsel's argument, if we were to accept that argument, it would be your position that we would then have to overrule Faust, Leverell, and Selleck. Is that correct?
That's right. Absolutely. Getting to the instruction, again, the trial court had problems with the allegation of malpractice and states things in there where he says in the instruction, I told you there's no issue of malpractice in this case. It's a difference of opinion whether the injuries were caused by the accident. He goes through many convoluted descriptions of this set forth in this instruction. This instruction needs to be clear and precise in order for the jury to be able to understand it, which is why they got confused and didn't award the money, the expenses for the surgery. Because there are many instructions that and I realize this court has held many times instructions don't have to be perfect, but there are many instructions, for example, where juries, for example, you instruct the jury that a left-turning driver has to yield right away. Well, most of the jurors all knew that before they came into court. It's a common instruction. But this is a little different. The average layperson doesn't know that if you injure someone negligently, the injuries are exacerbated by malpractice, that you, the original defendant, you're responsible for that. That idea, that concept, legal doctrine, has to be explained clearly and precisely, which it certainly wasn't done. Because the last thing that he says in the instruction, if you relate them to the accident, those injuries, she should receive the entire amount of damages. If you relate them, because that then says if you believe that Dr. Paul's testimony, their expert, that the surgery wasn't necessary, you don't have to award those damages. But under Wisconsin law, you do have to, because Dr. Paul stated that the reason she saw Dr. Lloyd was because of injuries sustained in this accident. He had no argument with any of the treatment before Dr. Lloyd became involved in the case. And the jury found
this. There was some question about whether $1,500 was given. I thought it was, but I couldn't. I was looking in the briefs here. Was the usual cause instruction given here?
As far as I can recall, it was. It was nothing.
Maybe given. Yeah, okay.
Counselor, if we would agree with your opinion that the second surgery was caused by the accident, do we have to have a new trial, or can we just reinstate the damages that you asked the trial court to reinstate and were refused there? Was $7,800 that you – $78,000, thank you. $78,000 that you requested, and the Court of Appeals gave that back but also ordered a new trial. And I guess my question to you is if we agree that the second surgery was caused by the accident, is there any need for a new trial?
Well, sure, certainly, because for this reason, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, because they didn't award her anything for the surgery, although the surgery was not related to the accident, and it certainly was, but because they concluded as they did, they ordered her nothing for any pain or suffering connected with the surgery, and that certainly should have been, and that's why the Court of Appeals ordered a new trial on that issue, because she should be awarded damages for having gone through the surgery, for having a permanent plate in her neck, and additional loss of earning capacity, all the elements of damage that were connected with her having that surgery. they were clearly not awarded by the jury, and that's why the Court of Appeals said that in a new trial, the medical bills are established as a matter of law at $78,000 and should be a new trial on the issues of pain, suffering, disability, and loss of earning capacity. And it's certainly justified by their opinion in this case.
Thank you.
Do you think that this jury instruction, or a jury instruction, should have used the singular injury rather than the plural injuries? I mean, your answer to Justice Butler was this is one injury to the neck, and then there was incorrect medical treatment. The insurance company takes the position there are two injuries, one caused by the accident, one not. Should you have used the singular injury?
You should use the singular because there's one injury, and the injury was exacerbated. The original injury was exacerbated by medical malpractice.
And if that was the fact situation, you clearly come into the prior cases.
That's right. You clearly apply, as the Court of Appeals said, this case, and the words they use, it's eerily similar to the Faust case, which is why Faust and Nehill were never cited in any of the briefs submitted by the petitioners in this case, because they're so supportive of our position in this case. There's no more questions. That's all I have.
I have a question.
Sorry.
The question is, with regard to the instruction 1710, what about the argument that you can have improper treatment or, I forget the other language from a case, incorrect treatment? It doesn't necessarily mean that it's negligent, does it?
No.
And yet the jury instruction deals just with doctors' negligence. And is that a problem? I don't know the answer. That's why I ask. I mean, should we you have the liberal case talks about, as I say, improper treatment. One other case talks about incorrect treatment. That was one of the earlier cases. Maybe Selleck, I can't remember which, but one of the earlier cases.
No.
And so do you need doctors' negligence in order for this doctrine of liability?
No, you don't. You don't. Most of the time it's going to be labeled by the defense doctor as improper, unnecessary, whatever. However it's labeled, it's rarely labeled as negligence.
It's true that it's not labeled, but what's the difference between improper, incorrect, and malpractice? Aren't they all negligent? That is, they fall below the standard of a doctor, a reasonable doctor, under those circumstances. How else do you get
away with all these questions?
I'm asking.
Well, okay.
A learned counsel.
All right, let's take something like this. This is a very common situation. Let's say someone has a herniated disc in an accident, okay? And there's no argument between both sides agree the herniated disc was caused by the accident. Plaintiff's doctor suggests and performs surgery on the herniated disc. Defense doctor comes in and says, I don't think surgery was a good idea here. I don't think that should have done more conservative treatment, shouldn't have done the surgery. The instruction would read that even if you, should be fashioned in some form to indicate that to the jury that even if you conclude that the surgery wasn't a good idea, wasn't warranted, nevertheless, the plaintiff still recovers for that because it was certainly caused by the accident, and if it was improper or not a good idea or unnecessary, it was undertaken by the plaintiff in good faith. She slept with the doctor in good faith, and therefore the all of the damages that follow because of that surgery should be awarded to the plaintiff. I mean, that's not the words, you know, you'd have to use a little more technical language than that in forging the instruction, but you're right. A lot of the times the treatment is not labeled as negligent.
Mr. Tarnoff, you represent plaintiffs and very well. Given the concerns expressed by your opposing counsel, what are the techniques that you would recommend to sort of limit damages here at causation, or would you recommend specific instructions of some kind, or special verdict questions, or?
The implication in their arguments that this has been a major problem for defendants defending cases, that hasn't happened. They defend cases successfully and win. Defense wins cases all the time where treatment is, all the medical bills are not awarded because of a number of reasons, including the fact that the plaintiff in some cases would be exaggerating. The jury could conclude that they ran up these bills just to build up a case, that the symptoms weren't legitimate. They have numerous defenses. They can defend on the fact, they can often defend that this wasn't caused by anything that emanated from the accident. It was caused by some pre-existing condition that had nothing to do with an accident, caused by some subsequent condition that had nothing to do with the accident. They have numerous defenses available to them and use them quite well, and which is why they prevail in many cases. So I don't know that there has to be any drastic change in the law from what it's been all these years.
How does the jury deal with those alleged defenses? Are they informed of those just in argument? Do they get instructions? Are there special verdict questions or what?
Well, it has to be in the record, in the evidence somewhere. It could be on just simply cross-examination of the plaintiff, bringing out previous records of the plaintiff, testimony by their expert. And, it's pretty common in this state. Let's say the plaintiff is claiming $10,000 in medical bills. The jury awards $8,000. They concluded that some of this wasn't necessary, wasn't done in good faith. The plaintiff was exaggerating. Whatever their conclusion in a given case is, they can award less than what the plaintiff is requesting. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tarnoff. Mr. Parley?
Thank you. Briefly, I do want to respond to a few points about what happened during the trial, and especially the contention that this C5, C6 radiculopathy was causally related to the accident. There was no testimony at this trial from any doctor who testified for the plaintiff or for the defense that the C5, C6 radiculopathy was causally related to this accident, which is why Mr. Tarnoff had to argue that it was our burden to rule it out. He just said that in his oral argument here. It was our burden to rule that out. It was discovered, therefore it must have been the result of the accident.
Just so I'm straight on this, Dr. Lloyd didn't testify?
No, he did not. Dr. Lloyd, in this record, never testified that the C5, C6 radiculopathy was due to the accident.
Did he testify, was there testimony that the surgery was done, using opposing counsel's term, emanating from the accident?
He, as I recall his testimony, he testified because of her complaints of chronic pain.
Which emanated from the accident? I'm just filling that in. I mean, there had to be.
Well,
she didn't get the.
Yes.
I mean, isn't that, from what I know from just what I read, that there was an accident and she was in pain because of back or neck injuries?
Justice Wilcox, the genesis and source of her pain at trial was an issue.
Okay.
I mean, we were at the point where, as I have indicated and as the briefs discuss, there was an issue of somatization as to whether the expression of her symptoms had any organic cause whatsoever. So that the best way I can respond to your statement is to state that that was an issue at trial.
But I thought I may have misunderstood. I thought that, at least in part, you were conceding because the jury came back with the $25,000 that, apparently the jury didn't accept your argument on that. Am I saying it correctly?
Justice Bradley, as I indicate from the quote from my closing argument, which is set forth in the brief, at trial, I indicated to the jury that on this record you could conclude that there was no injury resulting from the accident.
But that wasn't the thrust of my argument. Immediately after that, and again, the language is quoted in my brief, I said to them, we're not making that claim here. We're not saying she was not injured at all. We basically tried this case essentially conceding that she had a soft tissue injury. Dr. Paul, our own consultant, testified that she could have had a temporary minor soft tissue muscular injury as a result of the accident, and that explains the verdict. We never conceded, and in fact, it was the primary bone of contention at trial, or issue of contention, as to whether she had any injury to the spine proper. And we submit that the evidence was overwhelming that she did not, which explains the jury verdict.
Well, Dr. Moss showed evidence, MA, acute mild right C5, C6.
Correct. And that same doctor also recommended no surgery. There was no, that was not considered a clinically significant result. In other words, if all of us were tested electrodiagnostically after a certain age, we all find anomalies and radiculopathies and so forth. The question was whether it was associated with the accident. Dr. Ma, there is no testimony from Dr. Ma, Justice Wilcox, that this radiculopathy was caused by the accident.
Did he refer, who referred her to the neurosurgeon?
Mike, do you know?
I thought Dr. Ma.
That's what I.
We think it was Dr. Seidel.
Oh,
the family
doctor. Original doctor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another point, if I may. The question about good faith and whether that was recently raised on the part of the defense, good faith, members of the court, was an issue throughout this trial. This is why we raised the issue of somatization. This is why I argued on closing, in part, that the surgery was unrelated to the accident and unnecessary because she had seen two doctors before that who concluded that there was no causal connection. That, to me, raised a very serious issue of good faith with regard to this specific plaintiff and whether she exercised good faith not in selecting her physician, but along the separate criterion of whether she followed her doctor's advice in good faith.
I just want to make a correction. I said page 5 and 6. It's really 7 and 8 in your red brief. I had asked that question before in good faith.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to whether the medical malpractice allegation in a personal injury action is rare, I agree. Rarely does one hear a doctor accuse another doctor of malpractice for reasons which we need not delve into here. But doctors frequently, as we have already discussed during this argument, argue that certain treatment is unnecessary. And the concern here is that if unnecessary treatment rises to the level of malpractice as a matter of law, this is going to be a very common concern in the trial of personal injury cases. I cannot advance to the court a more persuasive example of the potentially perverse consequences of the Court of Appeals decision than Judge Gooley's own reaction when he received this unpublished decision in his courtroom. And I submitted as an affidavit to my petition for Supreme Court review the motions after verdict in another case where Judge Gooley, very soon after receiving the Court of Appeals decision in this Hansen case, specifically instructed the jury that essentially simply because the medical treatment at issue in that case, it was chiropractic treatment, was ordered, the jury basically had to include it as an element of compensation for the plaintiff. And those motions after verdict are included in that supplement to my petition. So the way in which Judge Gooley interpreted the Court of Appeals decision precisely confirms the potential negative consequences of that decision. He reacted to it in exactly the way we are saying should be a concern to this court.
Counsel, I know your red light's on, but opposing counsel said we would have to overrule Faust, Selleck, and Leverell. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely not. And that, the final thing I would like to say in response to that is to show just how those cases simply confirm what we're saying. Those cases in no way destroy the necessary causal relationship between the accident and the injuries at issue. One of our cardinal points is, before you reach the injury aggravation issue, there has to be a causal connection between the accident and some injury which is aggravated. There is a case cited in Waddell's brief. It's the Hanfanner's case. 240 West 2nd, 234. I asked the court especially to look at the discussion in that case on page 249. in the workers' comp context, where the standards for recovery are arguably more liberal than in a standard civil trial, they adopt exactly the analysis that I am espousing here. They say, and I quote, "We conclude that the Spencer rationale applies only to cases involving treatment for an undisputed compensable industrial injury." In other words, before you even reach the Spencer rationale, there must be a causal connection between the accident and some injury, which we say was lacking here.
You discussed that in your response brief? Or
no, I do not, you know, Chief Justice. That case was raised in Waddell's brief, however. It's the Hahnpenner's case cited within it.
Does that case make reference to the more recent legislation in workers' comp that addresses this issue?
Yes, it does.
Gotcha.
Yes, and if we had more time, we could discuss that, Justice Bradley, because I have the statute with me.
So do I.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Crowley, and thank you, Mr. Tarnoff, for your helpful arguments this morning. And that closes our hearing on 2004 AP 2065, Hansen versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company. The court will be in recess. The court will meet at 1:30 in the conference room. And those of you who are staying should stay, and the justice will be out shortly. We're in recess.